You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
During the Valerie Plame leak investigation, which lasted over 4 years, Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald subpoenaed members of the press and forced them to reveal how they'd learned she was a CIA operative. New York Times reporter Judith Miller served 85 days in jail for refusing to testify, but Time magazine's Matthew Cooper, under then-editor-in-chief Norman Perlstein's direction, testified and turned over his notes. Many journalists, including Frank Rich and the late David Halberstam, lambasted Mr. Perlstein for this decision, but in his new book, Off the Record, he responds to his critics while offering a cautionary tale on the use and perhaps abuse of anonymous sources. The book is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Perlstein to my show today. Hello.
Hi.
Why did you feel the need to write your side of this story? Were you trying to preserve your legacy, remove the tarnish from an otherwise distinguished journalism career?
Well, I think that actually by the time I began to write, a lot of the anger had dissipated, partly in response to Judith Miller's decision to seek a waiver and to get out of jail and testify herself. No, the reason I wrote the book was because I started out precisely where my critics were in the fall of 2004. I actually had a meeting with Dick Parsons, the CEO of Time Warner, where I said to him, look, reporters go to jail, companies pay fines, we're not going to turn over our notes. And 8.5 months later, I called him and said, I'm turning over the notes tomorrow. And what intervened in that period was, if you will, an education that that taught me all the things I thought I already knew about journalism.
Well, you'd gone to law school.
Correct.
So is, in this case, were you drawing upon your experience with the law?
Well, I hadn't meant to, but I had done a lot of work in the world of libel and had dealt with anonymous and confidential sources there, and as a reporter had certainly used anonymous and confidential sources myself. I had never had a case involving subpoenas from a prosecutor seeking grand jury testimony, and that was totally new for me. I also had a whole bunch of preconceptions about what the Pentagon Papers were all about, what Watergate was all about, that I found upon examination just didn't hold up. And then I also found that while I think journalists need anonymous and confidential sources, not enough journalists know the difference. And if we actually understood the difference, we would have concluded early on that Karl Rove was not confidential.
So let's make those distinctions.
Sure.
I know there's on the record, not for attribution, on background, on deep background.
Right. Off the record.
Somebody told me recently that he'd interviewed President Bush not long after he'd come to office, and the president asked him to identify him as a senior administration official.
Right.
That was the president of the United States.
Well, in Washington, most government officials want to speak not for attribution, and we've gotten to the point where, as it came out in the Libby trial, a number of our most successful and best journalists, including people like Tim Russert and Glenn Kessler from the Washington Post, ended up testifying to the fact that when they get on the phone with a senior government official, they assume the conversation is not for attribution, and it's only afterward that they might ask if there's something they can put on the record, whereas what we ought to be doing is working to get everything on the record. But to come back to your question, if you ask a group of journalists what all these terms mean, you get no consensus. For example, off the record actually means you cannot use the information in any way, shape, or form. And I think journalists should be really loath to ever take information as off the record.
Now, why would anybody give you off the record if you can't use it? Just to show off that they know something?
No, they might be. Let's say I call you up and say, look, I'm going to write a story about how you were actually a spy for Stasi in your position here. And you say, well, look, I really don't even want to
finally.
Yeah, I really don't want to even dignify that horrendous, outrageous idea. But off the record, I'll tell you, I was actually in the employment of the CIA trying to undermine Stasi. Well, you might not want that ever to surface, but you sure would be, you'd do anything to try to head off this wrong-headed story.
I have to tell you, my experience with this has been a little more casual because we all have had these experiences. People have called me and I've started telling a story and then I realize, hey, I can't let this story be published, at least not with Leonard Lopate said. So I'll say, look, I really don't want my name attached to that story. In fact, I don't even want that story published. Sometimes it's published without my name.
Sure.
Sometimes it's not.
Right. But confidential really implies a contract between us in which you're saying, look, I'm going to tell you something, and in doing so, I'm putting my reputation, my livelihood, maybe my life on the line, but this information is so much in the public interest that I'm willing to take that risk, but you really have to protect me. And it's not just you, it's your publication or your broadcast network. And before journalists agree to that, I think there has to be a clear understanding about why they're agreeing to it and not. There's an awful lot of anonymous source information that shows up in publications and on air. Pick up page 6 and you see who was canoodling at Tao or something like that. Is that confidential? No, I don't think so. And in the case,
but often they won't give the name.
Correct.
Now, why is that? They'll say what well-known sitcom star.
Well, this is, well, sometimes that's because they don't have a source, which is another. This would may go closer to misuse of sources. But Carl Rove's own stipulation with Matt Cooper was deep background. And what deep background, come back to your question of what all these sources, what these terms mean, deep background basically says, I'm going to give you information which you can either corroborate with somebody else, or if you want to say it on your own, that's fine. But you not only cannot attribute it to me by name, but you can't attribute it to a high government official or anything like that.
Now, in the case of Matthew Cooper, Karl Rove isn't the only one who told him about Valerie Plame Wilson.
Well, he's the only one who told him. He had Scooter Libby as a source as well. But with Libby, Matt said to him, I hear rumors that Wilson was sent to Niger by his wife, Valerie Plame. And all Libby said was, I've heard those rumors too. So, in fact, Rove was the only one who had given him that information.
My guess is Norman Perlstein, his book Off the Record, The Press, the Government, and the War Over Anonymous Sources, is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. I would have thought that this is the sort of thing you'd have to deal with a lot more at People magazine, another one of the publications that you oversee, than at Time.
Right.
But is this is it pretty much the same in both and any of the other publications?
A number of publications rely heavily on information from anonymous sources. In the sports world, all of the Balco coverage of steroids and so forth, the San Francisco Chronicle is doing, couldn't have been done without it. In Hollywood, certainly the publicists never want to be quoted on the record or for attribution, and so you'll get these bizarre stories that are sources, friends of, you know, and other times, it's people who work for the celebrity. So, yes, People magazine is a place where you're constantly watching this. I actually have an example in the book of a 516-word story involving Britney Spears and Kevin Federline that uses 15 anonymous references to anonymous sources.
Now, in the case of Rove and Matthew Cooper, you say it was deep background.
Correct.
And then he obviously went to Scooter Libby to get corroboration, although that's kind of odd because you go to the man's assistant, you're going to get the same information that you get from
Rove was Bush's chief strategist and Libby was technically Cheney's chief of staff, but you're right.
They're all pretty much working out of the same office.
Yeah.
But he did that, and then how did he use that?
Well, there were a couple of things that Matt did that I think frankly reflect his experience as a political reporter rather than as a lifetime investigative reporter. And as I've said in the book, I have great admiration for Matt as a journalist and think he has done some terrific work. But he'd been at the White House a couple weeks when this story broke. And immediately after hanging up the phone, the first thing he did was he sent an email to his bosses. And one of the things we now understand is that the E in email might as well stand for evidence, because once you put something in email, it's not restricted just to the person you send it to, and it is very hard to protect from subpoena.
So deep background became well-known fact.
Became well-known fact. Matt actually wrote
it. It broke any confidentiality they may have had.
Well, it made it. What it did was it institutionalized something that might have just been kept, if you will, with Matt and his editor. And one of the points I try to make is that I believe strongly that journalists have to protect their sources, and that individual reporters and their editors can engage in an act of civil disobedience if that's what's required to protect a confidential source.
Now, as the editor-in-chief of all of the magazines, how involved would you have gotten in the writing of the story? This was obviously seen as an important story.
Well, actually, it wasn't seen as that important a story. When Joe Wilson wrote his column, that was considered important because Bush had given three reasons for going to war: weapons of mass destruction, links between Saddam and al-Qaeda, and then this idea that the Iraqis were trying to restart their nuclear program by buying yellow cake in Africa. And Wilson comes out with his piece in July 6th of 2003 and says, hey, I went to Niger, there's nothing to this. So one of the three things doesn't work. So that was important.
And also, his article appeared 4 months after we went to war, as things were starting to look really bad
That's
in Iraq.
But on the other hand, the fact that, if you will, the administration was trying to smear Wilson by outing Valerie Plame, Matt wrote his memo to the editors at Time, who were doing a cover story that week on the whole unraveling called Untruths and Consequences. And they decided that the Plame angle wasn't worth playing up. So then Matt put it on the website a few days later at the request of his editors. But to come back to it, I had no understanding of any of this until much later.
So it never even appeared in the magazine. It was
only
on the website.
Just on the website.
And it's interesting that he got in trouble for the website. Judith Miller got in trouble for not even publishing an article.
Well, that's because the special prosecutor wasn't so much looking at publication. I mean, it was bizarre to us sitting there as editors to say, gee, Miller never even wrote a piece. Why is he subpoenaing her? But the special prosecutor was trying to figure out why Scooter Libby was lying under oath. And so he would go any place where he thought somebody had that information, whether he wrote a story or not.
Well, you don't even believe there should have been a special prosecutor.
I think that what the administration did to Valerie Plame is reprehensible and despicable and probably ended her career. But unfortunately, the laws on espionage, the so-called Intelligence Identities Protection Act, is written in a way that I thought it would have been almost impossible to get a conviction.
Do you see it ironic on any level that the same government that outed Valerie Plame Wilson is now preventing her from talking about how many years she worked at the CIA?
Yes, they're saying that her own book for, I think, Simon & Schuster can't be published because she cannot say what she was doing before 2002.
My guest is Norman Perlstein. His book, Off the Record, The Press, the Government, and the War Over Anonymous Sources, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Norman Perlstein, who is editor-in-chief of Time Incorporated, at least was from 1995 to 2005, previously managing editor at the Wall Street Journal. He's written a book called Off the Record, The Press, the Government, and the War Over Anonymous Sources, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Why did you switch from law to journalism?
Well, my father was a senior partner in a 20-man firm in suburban Philadelphia that included six of my relatives, and I basically went to law school because that's what a good son was supposed to do. And along the way, I started out working summer internships in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and just fell in love with news. So when I came out of law school, I started out actually as a copy boy at the New York Times and lasted there about 4 months, and then happily the Wall Street Journal picked me up to start writing in Dallas.
Well, often people who've been to law school wind up writing about legal matters, but you didn't do that.
No, I thought I was getting away from the law by going into journalism. And yes, over the years, I'd spent a lot of time with lawyers on libel cases and so forth. But I sort of prided myself on having escaped from the law until I got reeled back in by this case.
And when did you get involved in the controversy? Were the thing was published on July 17th, Matt Cooper's...
In 2003. Yeah. And Matt, I really got first involved with it in any meaningful way in May of 2004 when Matt first received his subpoena. And then my alarm bells really went off in August of 2004 when Time, Inc., the institution, was subpoenaed. And that was one of the things that distinguished us from the New York Times and Judith Miller was the Times was never held in contempt the way that Time, Inc. was.
And why do you think that is?
Well, because since Judy had never written a story, they took the position that, that she still possessed the notes and that they weren't the property of the Times. We take the position that the work product of our journalists is belongs to Time, Inc. And we had these emails that I mentioned that put us in a position where at least a couple dozen people could have been subpoenaed because they had access to them.
I would assume that once this started happening, everyone at Time Warner got involved.
You know, they didn't for a couple of reasons. One is we're Time Warner is a very decentralized company because these divisions are so massive.
So Dick Parsons didn't talk to you about this?
I first talked to Dick Parsons in October of 2004, and I asked for the meeting. He had not discussed it. I mean, the General Counsel of Time, Inc. does not report to the General Counsel of Time Warner. We're pretty separate. And secondly, I operated under a document called the Role of the Editor-in-Chief at Time, Inc., which clearly stipulates that the words and pictures in the magazines are the responsibility of the editorial and of the editor-in-chief, and any legal issues that would grow out of it were basically my problem.
So there was a subpoena, and then there was a second subpoena.
Correct.
And there was a grand jury request.
Correct.
And what happened there?
Well, what happened was that in October of 2004, a district judge in Washington, D.C., turned down our request to get the subpoenas thrown out. And keep in mind, Fitzgerald had actually subpoenaed six journalists. He'd subpoenaed Bob Novak. He'd subpoenaed Glenn Kessler and Walter Pincus at the Washington Post. He had subpoenaed Tim Russert at NBC, and then Judy Miller and Matt Cooper. And those four journalists had figured out a deal where they were able to testify, and the subpoenas got dropped. We did a deal for Matt to testify about Libby, which we thought would end his whole case, but Fitzgerald came back to us following that testimony and said, well, it looks like there's another source I have to ask you about, and that was Karl Rove, and that's what we took all the way up to the Supreme Court and lost.
Did you consider having Cooper ask Karl Rove for a confidentiality waiver at that point?
Yeah. The question of when to seek a waiver and how to do it was something that came up along the way. And there were various times when different people had different ideas about it. If I had it to do over again, that's probably the first thing we would have done when we got the subpoena, given that, if you will, if I had it to do over again, I would have also immediately questioned, why are we calling him a confidential source instead of an anonymous source? I was late to the party on those things, and I replay that game a lot in my head. By the fall of 2004, we were already involved in a legal process, and what I felt was, let's go through all the legal battles, because if we can win it in the courts, we don't have to ask.
And your first counsel is one of the most respected First Amendment Absolutely. Lawyers in America, Floyd Abrams. Was he already representing Judith Miller at
No,
the same
he
time?
First was representing Matt Cooper. Then Judith Miller was subpoenaed, and he talked to our counsel about that. And at that point, we thought that Matt's testimony on Libby would get him out of this and he could just go off and do Miller. Then it turned out we got a second subpoena for this second source. So he was representing both of us with the approval of our in-house counsel, who thought that the legal issues were comparable. There was some efficiency in having one person represent both of us. And at that point, frankly, I was happy to have Floyd representing us because he is one of the great, if not the greatest, First Amendment lawyer going.
But then you decided to find new counsel.
Correct.
And a very surprising choice. Now, why did you drop Floyd, and why did you go after Ted Olson,
right,
who had worked for the Justice Department during the first
Bush
administration.
Well, he was Solicitor General during the Bush administration. With regard to Floyd, the primary thing that I came to realize was that there were, in fact, differences between the New York, between Judith Miller and Matt Cooper and Time Inc., that there was a conflict there because we had a corporation that had been held in contempt and they did not.
And Floyd had a long history with the New York Times.
Very long, going back to the Pentagon Papers, which really made his career. He also had a second case with Judith Miller and Fitzgerald in Chicago, the case involving the phone records on the Muslim charity. He was representing James Risen and Eric Lichtblau in the Wen Ho Lee case. And he had a lot of other things going on with the New York Times. So I felt that there was basically a conflict there that I recognized and thought we should have separate counsel. With regard to Ted Olson, Ted had a history of being a very good and very effective First Amendment lawyer with the Gibson Dunlap firm in Los Angeles. He'd represented the Los Angeles Times for years. He'd represented Newsday and Timothy Phelps in the case growing out of the Clarence Thomas hearings. He was really such a strong advocate for representing the media in libel cases that he had a policy that Gibson Dunn would not take any plaintiff's libel work. But he had also been Solicitor General. He knew the judges. He had argued 43 cases in front of this court. And I thought that we would benefit from having somebody with his perspective.
Even though he might very well have been more inclined to support the administration than Karl Rove.
Well, look, he's a friend of Scooter Libby's. He knows Rove. He is a player in Washington who every time there's a cabinet opening, you know, if Gonzalez were to go, his name gets thrown out and so forth. But I knew the work of Gibson Dunn going back to when Robert Sack, who's now on the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, was doing their libel work in New York. I was comfortable with the firm, and the minute I met Olson, I knew we would get great representation.
Didn't he even approach you about defending Libby?
He didn't approach me. He raised the question after our case had been concluded. I'm sorry. You're right. He came. Let me get
when,
this straight.
When Libby
was indicted, which was after Matt had testified, he came to us and said, "Would you grant a waiver so that I can write a letter on behalf of Libby? I would not be He wasn't asked to represent Libby, and he never suggested that he would be representing him, but he wanted to show his support for him. And we said no. We said that's a waiver we're not comfortable giving you."
My guest is Norman Perlstein, who's written a book called Off the Record, The Press, the Government, and the War Over Anonymous Sources, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So then you decided that you also would start doing your own little digging into the case history.
Right.
And the Pentagon Papers, we'd mentioned earlier, Floyd Abrams
sure.
became famous. They seem to be the most obvious
right.
precedent.
Well, there were really three obvious precedents, two that really involved the federal courts. The Pentagon Papers, Watergate, and then the Myron Farber case in New Jersey.
Well, you didn't want to have anything like Myron Farber's situation occur here. He did the time.
He did time, and yet you could say, when I agreed to hand over our notes, the immediate reaction from the New York Times was, well, unlike Time Inc., when Myron Farber was faced with a very similar situation, he went to jail and we paid fines. And that was the analogy that Arthur Sulzberger Jr. used when I made the decision. So that was a relevant case as well. But the Pentagon Papers, you know, memory plays tricks on you. When you think back to the Pentagon Papers, you think about Daniel Ellsberg. Floyd Abrams in his book refers to Ellsberg as a confidential source, for example. You think about Ellsberg, you think about the New York Times defending their sources and so forth, even when Bill Sapphire did a eulogy for Abe Rosenthal He referred to the Pentagon Papers those ways, but it was really a case of prior restraint. The Times was about to publish these, or started publishing them. John Mitchell tried to stop them. And the interesting thing to me was that Arthur Sulzberger, the then publisher, father of the current publisher, said, and Max Frankel wrote a story that appeared on the front page of the New York Times reflecting his statement, that if the Supreme Court ruled against the New York Times, he would cease publication, which basically said, here's a media company that is as ferocious in its defense of the First Amendment as anybody going. It says, if the Supreme Court rules against us, we're going to stop publication because we don't know how as a media company to defy a Supreme Court order. And that was what I took away from the Pentagon Papers. Watergate, and by the way, Ellsberg says now that he was not a confidential source, he was an anonymous source, which is just a little side aspect to it. On Watergate, Carl Bernstein has made quite a bit of the fact that he received a subpoena and that Katherine Graham took possession of his notes, the so-called gray-haired widow defense, because that was the way to protect the papers. What is lost in that is that neither Archibald Cox, the special prosecutor, nor John Sirica ever tried to find out who the Washington Post's confidential sources were. What happened was there was a civil lawsuit involving the committee to reelect the president and the Democratic National Committee, where the Washington Post, as well as several other news organizations, including Time Magazine, were subpoenaed, and the district judge threw it out. A totally different case from my own. And in Farber, which I think is really the closest analogy, I think it's a very close call, and I'm not sure what I would do if I were Farber. It was a murder case involving a doctor who had allegedly used curare to kill some of his patients 10 to 12 years before Farber's piece ran. And his piece led to the indictment of the doctor. And Farber, the defense attorney said, I want all your notes because I can't conduct a defense in a murder trial without them. And Farber's defense was an interesting one. I said in his book, he talks about this, and he says that following Abe Rosenthal's belief that we should fight this on principle, we decided we were not going to turn over our notes, even though the defense counsel knew who my sources were, even though the information I had would be of no use to him, and even though the judge was willing to take a look at these notes in camera and make a decision about whether they were useful or not.
And it was that on principle that people attacked you as well.
Correct.
You, I'm sure you thought about that. Yeah. Should we withhold these notes on principle?
Well, I think there may be cases where you do, but I felt in this case where, if you will, the confidentiality had been compromised by the existence of the emails, where Karl Rove did not fit my definition of someone deserving confidential source status because he wasn't a whistleblower, as Patrick Fitzgerald suggests. He was somebody trying to undermine a whistleblower. This didn't seem to me the case where you made that kind of distinction.
But were you at all concerned that some people might see you as setting a dangerous precedent?
Oh, absolutely. I call this the most difficult decision I had to make in more than 35 years in the business. And that's because a number of the most thoughtful people whom I know basically were exactly where I was in the fall of 2004 before I did this kind of work and this kind of digging.
Now, there have been any number of proposals for federal shield laws.
Correct.
Would a federal shield law have aided your defense?
Yes.
I think it's unlikely
we're going to get one. I don't think there's a lot of popular support for the media these days. We're not held in high regard.
But we do see them on the state level around
we
the
do.
Country.
We have more than 30 states have passed shield laws, and every state but Wyoming, either through a shield law or through court rulings, provides some kind of protection for journalists. We've been trying to get a federal shield law really for 35 years. There's a law currently in the Congress which, at the last time I checked, only 7 senators had agreed to co-sponsor, and only one of them, Chris Dodd, is running for president.
But, you know, if you were to ask the public who's right and who's wrong in this story, I think most people would come on, you know, vote on the side of Matthew Cooper and not Karl Rove. I'm not sure about Judy Miller because of all the other things
right.
that have happened.
Well, and at least the people at the Times believe that Judy actually could have gotten the waiver a year earlier, and that, in fact, her notes didn't have information on other confidential sources that she had to protect. So that's what raised all the questions about why she was going to jail.
What's your reaction to the president's commuting the Scooter Libby sentence?
I think it's an outrage. As Patrick Fitzgerald said in his summation to the jury and in his sentencing memorandum asking for incarceration of up to 37 months, he said, there's a cloud over the vice president, there's a cloud over the White House, and that cloud exists because of Scooter Libby's obstruction of justice. And I never got to really know what this whole thing was all about, why the administration was doing the stuff it did because of his obstruction of justice.
Now you're working at the Carlyle Group,
right.
private equity. Is that a lot easier than being at Time?
Oh, no. Well, I've only been there as a senior advisor since last September, and I can only tell you we haven't done a deal since I've been there.
In May, I spoke with Time Magazine's Matthew Cooper about his role in the Plame case, and we posted a link to that interview on our show page. So if you want to go back and hear his take on it, you can just go to WNYC.org. My great thanks to Norman Perlstein. His book, Off the Record, The Press, the Government, and the War Over Anonymous Sources. It is published by Farrah, Straus, and Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure. ¶¶